Hello, everyone. Welcome to my podcast. My name is Amar Singh, and this is Amar's Curiosity of Being. Today, we will be interviewing a great friend of mine, Mr. Philip Princeton. This gentleman has done everything in this amazing life. And one of the things I really appreciate about him and being around him, he is always happy. He's an adventurous soul. He's done everything from being a bicycle courier to being a location scout in the film industry to being a truck driver. Heck, he even tried being a comedian for 5 minutes. But the reason why we're interviewing him here today, he was actually one of the top cocaine drug dealers in the 80s and 90s in Toronto until he got busted. And subsequently, he changed his life around. And in fact, he's living in Vietnam right now, working his way to become a Buddhist monk. So I hope you guys enjoy this episode. And if you're ready, let's jump right in. Thank you for being here. Hey, buddy, how are you?
Well, you know, fucking awesome.
As always. I like the quote. What's the quote back there I'm seeing behind you? By Gandhi.
Zoom in on that for a second. Just change my name to Mr. Kemp here. Okay, so this is
Gotcha. Live as if you were to die tomorrow. Learn as if you were to live forever. Mahatma Gandhi. Cool. Where are you right now? Are you at home?
Yeah, this is my room. It's my bedroom.
Oh, nice.
My room. Yeah. It's very cool. It's private bathroom, whole thing. And nice.
Wow.
And a view. But I'm about 2 minutes from the beach on my Vespa. So it's great. And so it's good. And I live in a big new building. I live for free because I do volunteer teaching. Are you recording this?
Yes, I am. Yes. So what did you say? You live for free because you teach?
Yes, I do volunteer teaching at an English center called Prime. And because it's basically people can drop in, have a coffee, and talk to foreigners, English-speaking foreigners, teachers, to improve their English speaking. The Vietnamese are among the most hungry to learn English. Out of every other Asian culture, bar none, over above Japan, Korea, everybody. They're not interested. They don't care. They're like, it's like an add-on. For some reason, Vietnam has realized, and it's been implemented into their education system, that English is paramount. You know, not only speaking, but grammar. So they teach them from a young age. The benefit when I teach my students is they already know how to read and write. And their spelling is impeccable. I'll make a mistake on the board and they'll be freaking out. Mr. Kemp, Mr. Kemp. I'm like, what is it? What is it? Right? It's wrong. Your word's wrong. They freak out because they just have to. They're so the epitome of a communist kind of regime. It's just like, this is it. The correct answer. So it's just so beneficial because I learn how to work with them. It took me like 6 months to a year, really, to be malleable enough to be able to teach them properly. And I have now risen to be the top English-speaking teacher in Vietnam, if in Da Nang, but if not in Vietnam.
Wow.
And I paid my dues. It's been four years now.
You spent 4 years in Da Nang, where that's where you are right now, and that's where you came first, right?
I came first to Saigon, to Ho Chi Minh. Okay. We flew in there in October in 2016 to work on the film with Tina. I think you remember Tina, 3T Karma. When she was younger, she was a Vietnamese boat person. And a Vietnamese boat person is a person that basically had to leave at the end of the war when people were kind of taking sides. The communist won. So the people who were fighting against the communists were basically, they said, you know, you can stay, but we're going to kill you. Or you can get the fuck out and get on a boat. No other way out. No other way. So they got on the boats.
Sorry, the communists said that, or the communists.
The communists, wow. Yeah. Because it was north and south. The north won communism. And even as you travel through the north now into Tet Holiday, the Lunar New Year, you can see the hammer and sickle of the Soviet along with the Vietnamese flag. Right? Wow. And everybody flies their flag. It's a very proud society. It's a very unique society, and especially this time of year, which just is starting next week. Basically, it starts on my birthday. So all of Vietnam will be celebrating my birthday while they celebrate Tet Holiday. So thank you. Thank you, Vietnam. Yes.
Yeah. So why do they call you Mr. Kim, or you change your name? Like, what's that all about?
What do you think? What do you think? Because you might have a bit of a social media.
You've changed your name before, so this time I just said, "Oh, here he goes again." so that's why.
Too funny. Thank you.
So yeah. So what was that? What was that about?
like John Priner said one time when I took off to Costa Rica, he said, "Did you have to flee the country? Did they after you? The law after you?" You know, John Priner. I'm like, no, dude, I just couldn't take it anymore. I was over-socialized. I had to get the fuck out. It was just too good of a life. No one can live that good of a life, okay? It's not sustainable. It's not physically sustainable or mentally sustainable. So, when 6 months in Saigon working on the film, we had been positioned in a really great way. The film was Three Cheek Karma about Vietnamese boat people. I can send you the screenplay. It's fucking an awesome screenplay. She wrote it so well. It's Tina. She has five boys, but the opening scene is Vietnamese boat people fleeing, and not on a great ship, on just a boat, overcrowded, right? Nowhere to go but out. Hopefully somewhere, some destination, somebody accepts them. Somebody gives them water or food or fuel, whatever. It was a treacherous thing. Well, her opening scene is that as they're going out of Ha Long Bay, which is a beautiful place in Vietnam with like cavernous kind of like structures jetting out of the water that you go around, a typhoon came in and blew their ship back into a cave.
Oh, wow.
So at the time, she had a six-year-old baby and a 1.5-year-old son and her husband on the boat with all these other people. They have nothing. Maybe they have a bit of money in their bag, but it's going to be extorted from them once they get to any other shore, right? It's a treacherous situation and a pummeling story of complete defeat, but she came back in such a way. Anyway. So her baby ends up dying like on the sixth day in the cave on the boat.
Wow.
So that's the opening scene. It's called Heaven's Gate, 3T Karma Heaven's Gate. It's basically opening up the gate to heaven. Now they had to go on. They had to stay on the ship and go on to see where they're going to go.
This is not based on a true story or anything like that, obviously.
Yeah,
right?
No, it is. A complete true story.
Oh, yes. It is.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. Exclusively a true story, right? Right from our heart all the way through. That's why I followed it. That's why, I left Canada because I couldn't take the winters anymore. I wasn't enjoying the lifestyle. I was, you get to your top of your game and then all of a sudden your foundation starts crumbling and you're like, I got to get the fuck out of here. So I'm glad I did. So that being said, Ho Chi Minh, 6 months, film crew, great experience, met major people. You can't film in Vietnam unless you have the highest of the highest of the highest of commands of authority that say, yes, you can film. Everything has to be authentic. We were meeting with all of those people every day. District 12, District 1, District 5, riding on our motorbikes in the sea, hundreds of thousands of people on motorbikes this far apart from each other, like fish going through traffic. They don't even stop. They'll go on the sidewalks. They're up over the sidewalks. It's just chaos. So I had to escape from that because it was a great experience. And she had me up 5 o'clock every morning, 5 days a week, going to the gym. I was working out 5 days a week at 5 in the morning. Sometimes we'd get to the gym before it opened. We'd have to go for a coffee and go back.
Why was it important for you to get to the gym?
Well, it wasn't important for me at all. It was important
for her. That's what I mean. Why?
Because as you're building a film crew, you want them to be healthy, strong, moving forward. We have a lot of work to do. We'd be like traveling a lot of ground. We're going to film throughout Vietnam and then back into Toronto afterwards. So, and I probably wasn't going to go back for the Toronto part, but I was in for the Vietnamese part of the filming.
So what does that have to do with the name, Mr. Kim?
Oh, fast track. I left Saigon because I couldn't take it anymore, and I wanted to go to the best beaches in Vietnam. I phoned my friend Annie To. You might know her, the Vietnamese girl who I came to Vietnam with. She was part of us, but she went off with her girlfriend. She was in Ninh Binh near Ha Long Bay. I phoned her from Saigon. I said, I just want the best beach in Vietnam. Where the hell is it? That's all I want. Da Nang, I'll meet you there. I said, okay, tomorrow, done. Booked the ticket, flew. Soon as I hit the ground in Da Nang, I was like, you know what? Love this place. Something feels right about it. Airport, 10 minutes from your hotel on the beach. Beach, 1 minute walk from your hotel to the beach. Beautiful beach. Wow. This beach you can walk. Dude, I walked 2.5 hours one day. And I realized I didn't really take any money with. I didn't take any money with me. I had a bottle of water that was gone. I was walking to Hoi An, and then I had to walk 2.5 hours, like 3 hours back. Okay, it's just like so. The beach is beautiful, right? Nice. Just the right amount of white sand. Great temperature. Overall conditions safe as well. Undertow, not huge. You know, comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
kind of like Costa Rica. And so as soon as I get into Da Nang, I start to figure out, okay, what I'm going to do, what's my assessment on this. Lo and behold, there was no fresh fruit and vegetable ice cream available in Da Nang. So I looked at that niche market and I thought, wait, it's booming here. People are coming from, you know, Koreans, Japanese, Chinese, Philippines, everywhere, but also Canadians, Americans, British. This place was, before Corona, this place was like, blow up because it's the least expensive place to live in the world.
So it slowed down a lot because of Corona?
It's just like snails. It's like a sloth now, like a sloth.
And everyone still masks up and everything? Like, how was the situation there? Is everything locked down?
We were good until about 2 weeks ago and perfect overall, like no mask and anything. But there has been some cases reported in the north now. There were 84 like 3 days ago. Now there's 100. So the north is having some issues. They're closer to the Chinese border. They Chinese kind of sneak in sometimes. We don't know if it's flight attendants or immigrants or what it is. Sometimes it's people coming back from other countries, Vietnamese coming from other countries that came back, and that's what happened. Then a flight attendant and then a guy. They're great at isolating things rapidly here. And we're already a society of wearing masks. So it's not like a big deal to us. Now we're not going to wear the mask. Well, we're already wearing it. So I think we're okay.
Right? When you go to a restaurant, do you mask up as well? Or it's not that prevalent in restaurants, let's say?
When we went through our first phase, which I had the great fortune to live in a beautiful villa, again, for free. Because I was working with a vegetarian restaurant with opening up their project. I was the project manager. So I was there isolated. So that was kind of like I just go to the store. But yes, you go to the store with the mask on. The vendor has the mask on. It's kind of like protocol. And then it goes away. Everything opens up. It eases up. Then we get hit by a second week. And it was just a fluke that it happened in Da Nang, right? Just a fluke that it was a Japanese flight attendant, right?
So that was ground zero for Vietnam. It was Da Nang where it started.
No. That was the second wave that it hit us with a minor hit.
Okay.
But it grew up into 26 cases, which is not a lot of cases.
That's right.
Considering 2,000 a day in every state. or whatever the hell is going on over there. Our position now is we were failing quite nicely. Now, because of the cases, people start to kind of think about it. And hopefully, because right now it's mass transition of Vietnamese going from one place to another, because it's Lunar New Year, they go back to their hometown, visit their families. And this was all started a long time ago with Ho Chi Minh, called the Tet Offensive. And the Tet Offensive was, they said, listen, we're fighting against Americans. They made a deal with the Americans saying, listen, how about we just stop the war for 2 weeks? Mm-hmm. How about we just stop the war? Let our, because back, they didn't have communications. Families didn't even know if their loved ones were alive. They didn't know where they were. They had no community. Like, it was basically complete chaos, right? We've all seen the movies. Good morning, Vietnam. Yeah. And so it was basically a product of, hey, wait a second, let's just give our people a rest. Give your people a rest. Let's take a break here, because around the world, we're realizing it's the politics that are fueling this whole albatross. It was just fucking apocalyptic.
So is this home for you now? Is that, is this, because with you, Philip, I've known you for almost 30 years. And, you know, one thing I know about you, I don't know if you're going to be doing this 5 years from now. I mean, you've lived the most colorful life of anyone I've known. Like, seriously, I mean, you've been a truck driver, you've been a courier, you've worked in the film industry as a location scout. You owned a clothing store.
I used to be a pretty good host.
There you go.
At a club called Exit to Eden, and there's these two jokers.
That's
who talked
right.
me into this shit, but I'm glad that they did.
Yeah, you were hosting with us, with Bill and I, when we promoted Nightclub. So you've done so much. So this is home for you now. Is that what you're standing by?
Yes, and that's my story, and I'm sticking to that. Just the facts, okay. Man. Just the facts. But that's for the here and now. And the here and now is that I always pick a safe place to live in the world. You remember that I moved to Costa Rica, and you somehow found me in the middle of nowhere while I was in the shower with my girlfriend.
That was a crazy trip.
my God.
No phones, nothing. We spoke a month prior, and you said, hey, come on down. Oh, I'm just three houses from the post office. And I can't believe, because I'm not as adventurous as you are. And I actually jumped on a plane. And it was when I owned Roxy Blue and I needed a break. I was just so stressed out. And I had quit smoking as well. And I came and I had the time of my life. And yeah, it was funny. It was dark. It was like 8 o'clock at night, pitch dark. And I hear, you know, these two people laughing, and I knock on the door, and both you and Jules are butt naked. And you both ran out and hugged me and went, oh my God, you made it. Wow, what a beautiful, to this day, it's the best vacation I've ever had, because it was just so raw and so real. And that's why I wanted to interview you, buddy, because you know, you're happy wherever you stand. And, you know, the world is lacking that now. And even for myself, you know, I'm the complete opposite. Everything has to be planned. Everything has to be, you know, structured. For you, you know, you're like, oh, it feels good. Let's go. And, you know, it's great to see where you came from as well. And, you know, the reason I wanted to do this interview with you is because you went from being, you know, a cocaine drug dealer, and now you're, you know, teaching Buddhists, and you're looking to become a full-fledged, you know, Buddhist. You're going to shave the head and everything?
Yeah, buddy, it's no problem. I think it was like a year ago, around this time, and I'm going to do it again, actually, on Friday, I shaved my head very short, right? Because it grows back in a couple of weeks. It's just like mushrooms. So, yeah, so the hair thing is not, people think the hair thing is a big deal. No, it doesn't matter. I shaved my head, I shaved my balls, I shaved my arm, everything good.
No, but getting back to the Buddha, like, what's your long-term goal with regards to the Buddhist religion?
Because I've had the great fortune of getting involved very rapidly with master monks. I was invited to teach at, and you can go back through my social media and you can see all of the, you know, the logistics of how it all was happened. I was invited to teach at a Buddhist English center called Tree Fem. It was the most popular English teaching center in Da Nang, meaning the most kids who sought after to go there. Also, it was the cheapest. The Buddhist monk had set it up as a basically a charity. You give what you can, right? So we give what you can. Basically, the kid can go, he can go to 24 classes. No, he can go to 24 classes a month for like $12. So, right? But I still get paid quite well, 450,000 Vietnam dong, which is about $21 an hour. And so I was invited into this wonderful world by this master monk, Master Monk Long. And it was a trip. I mean, not only was I teaching like 32 kids, like back to back to back to back on classes, then he sometimes would have me fill in for his class. His class was 98 students, right? It was like a lecture hall. So his room was right next to mine. So then I got the next thing. He hired me because I was Buddhist. So I got the next kind of like perk.
What do you mean he hired you? Hang on a second. Back up. What do you mean he hired you because you were Buddhist? When you went to Vietnam, you had already decided you were going to be a Buddhist?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. I was already, I was Bohemian in Costa Rica.
That's right.
So, you know, I have to keep moving to something else, right? So I just got, hey, what's next? Well, let's just go to Sufi mysticism or Buddhism. Okay, that kind of covers.
Well, that's why when you say you're a Buddhist, I have to ask you, you know, what's your long-term plans? Because, you know, a year from now, I might be talking to you and, you know, I'll ask you, you know, so how's the Buddha thing going? You might be going, what are you talking about, dude? I'm in Afghanistan fighting for the resistance or something.
It could be that simple, right? Yeah. Dude, no, it was like, the funny thing is you say that because Myanmar is having a lot of issues right now politically because the government just decided to say, you know what? Fuck your freedom. We gave it to you. Now we're taking it away and you're not having it anymore. We're taking back our country, the military, right? And so we're not going to be like puppet master to this prop up government that is like being run by all kinds of shit. So the shit's hitting the fan then. So pops into my head, I'm going to Myanmar. I'm going to go to Myanmar and I'm going to try to figure this out and kind of resolve this issue and have some kind of diplomatic diplomacy. And I'm basically being a go-between sort of a negotiator. And then I thought, shut the fuck up. You just stay where you are, is safe, stay put. You're not going anywhere. You're doing what you're supposed to do. You have purpose. You're making money. Stop.
Doesn't that go against the Buddhist teaching, though? I mean, to, you know, relinquish everything and not focus on money?
True.
So you're not there yet. You're working towards that. It's work in progress. Yeah.
It's a work in progress.
You still didn't answer Mr. Kim. So
isn't that funny? So I will digress back to our point. Just one thing prior to, though, the master monk says, Mr. Kim, and everybody calls me Mr. Kim. Nobody calls me Philip Princeton. It's not that I'm like hiding because I'm in
full sight. But why did he call you Mr. Kim in the first place?
Because I'll tell you why in a second. Right after I tell you what he gave me. He said, I've selected you out of every teacher I know, and he knows a lot, and every Buddhist, and I would like you to teach the Buddhist monks and the Buddhist nuns at our center together for a six-month program. Buddhist monks and Buddhist nuns from all over, all kinds of pagodas, all over Vietnam, coming here to learn. I was blown away. It was like, said, okay. And I would often joke with him. He was a funny guy, right? He's a funny guy. So I'd often joke with him and I'd say, what should I teach him? What should I teach him? Like, it's just, you know, like, he goes, Mr. Kemp, you're a good Buddhist. You don't have to be a Buddhist monk to really be like a monk. You don't have to go through all the ordeal like I had to go through. I want you to teach them about meditation, Buddhism, and English. And dude, at the time, my hair was long and curly. It was like long and curly, and I was wearing like one of those hats, like a pith helmet.
I bet it was orange color too.
It was actually white. I transitioned from that orange into the white. Thank goodness. Thank goodness. Yeah. So Mr. Kemp, so I get to Da Nang and I'm thinking, what am I going to do? And I think, well, what does it need? What could it use? What could I excel at? Where is the market? You know, like I looked around. Okay. Did my research, met everybody rapidly. Oh, wait a second. Just prior to Mr. Kemp, I decided to put on a 4-day music conference called Buddha Life. And I got people involved. And we got involved and we had meetings and we had an office and we had all kinds of stuff going on. We just ran into a little red tape, and sponsorship is not a possibility here because they want to pay you after the event, right? Ticket sales prior to? No, they'll buy it on the day and it's so cheap. So basically I nixed it. But what that did was I got to meet everybody in the hotel industry because we were going to have it in 4 or 5 different places. And it was called Buddha Life, and it was all going to be about just like a Buddha Life music conference, like really like trippy with monks and everything and just the whole new thing. And it was a great possibility because of what was happening in Da Nang. But after that, did not really go exactly to plan, and I decided to just pull the plug nicely, but still got a lot of, you know, generation from it. I said, well, I'm going to start an ice cream company. What is ice cream in Vietnamese? Kem.
Gotcha. Okay.
So what's ice cream? You say, hey, so we say, hey, you want to go for ice cream? You want to go for Kem?
Kem.
Right? Okay. Gotcha. So Kem. So I said, well, Kem. I said, wait a sec. I can be Mr. Kem. I can be Mr. Kem. I can do this. I can be Mr. Kem. Right? So I just started the company. How do you start a company in Vietnam? You get some stickers. You do some advertising. There's no such thing as a license. There's no nothing. I don't have a motorbike license. It's like the Wild Wild West still. It's fucking perfect for me.
That's so funny. You've had so many names, starting with Flipper.
Yeah. And Chandy Moker.
That's right, Chandy Moker. How about Philip Imangera?
Yeah, the big one, the hose from Peter at the myth, right?
That's right.
I like that one. I love that one. That got me so much action, buddy. You had pictures. I told you, you had pictures behind the bar. You show the girls. Next thing you know, the girls like, hey. And I'm like, hey. And then she's like, let's go. I'm like, hey.
Okay. So,
thank you, Peter. Thank you, Peter.
Okay. Now that you've answered, Mr. Kem, I want to pull this back a little bit.
And it's a very popular brand, let me tell you. All fresh fruit and vegetables, all natural. No sugars, no additives. Was available prior to Corona. I had it in 7 locations.
Wow. Right?
I had it in the most predominant vegetarian restaurant called Mud Bistro. So
did you manufacture this as well? Or
yes. What? Yes. I produced it, delivered it. I had it on my motorbike delivering at the beach, me delivering with the hat on, the whole thing. It would be about an hour and a half and it would all melt. It was so, it's so hot here in Vietnam. It's so fucking hot in Vietnam.
So what happened? Why did you get rid of the business?
I haven't got rid of the business.
I'll
start up this spring. I'll start up this spring. Corona, buddy. Corona.
Okay. Gotcha. Gotcha. So
nobody's going to be licking any of my ice when Corona's happening.
Yeah, that's awesome. So, like I said, I want to pull this back to when we first met. We've known each other for 30 years, and it's I want to give a little bit of a background with regards to you and the dealing the cocaine and what happened, because it's a funny story. Yeah, it's funny because you and I had known each other for a couple of years before I had this conversation with this girl. You and I had a blast. We would, you know, you never had a job. I always wondered, you know, and you would say, well, you know, I did real estate, which you did in the day. And
But don't underestimate my real estate.
Oh, no, your
ability.
you were,
because it was,
it was
high level shit.
That's right. This was before the bubble that happened. Was it 1990, the real estate bubble in Toronto, around that time?
No, it burst in 1987.
Okay.
Yeah, so 1987.
So, gotcha. So you had done extremely well with the real estate. And prior to that, you also did the clothing store and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I'll let you talk about that in a second. You and I were hanging out and, you know, going to clubs. I mean, I was in my, you know, late 20s, early 30s, and we would be playing chess at the Rivoli on Queen Street. And I remembered, I went to a party and this girl said, "Hey, I saw you with Philip last weekend. How do you know Philip?" I said, "Oh, Philip's a great guy. I've known him for, you know, a couple of years. And yeah, he's just such an awesome guy to be around, blah, blah, blah." And she said, "Well, is he still dealing cocaine?" And I said, "What? Philip? Philip Princeton?" She goes, "Yeah." I said, "Philip Princeton, redhead Philip." She goes, "Yes." She goes, "Obviously, you're not aware of that." I said, "What are you talking about? Get out of here, Philip Princeton, dealing cocaine." She goes, yeah. "He goes, Amar, he's one of the biggest cocaine dealers. I mean, he doesn't deal, you know, he deals to all the lawyers and doctors and all the well-to-do in society in Toronto. If they're doing cocaine."
The elite of the elite.
That's
the
right.
Of the elite.
Yeah.
And their fathers.
That's
and
their right. fathers. There you go. And I said, you know, I said, "Come on." So I laughed and I completely fluffed it off. Right. And then the next day I just said, "Hey, buddy, how's it going?" And I said to you,
"By the way."
Yeah. And you're always happy and go lucky, just like the way you are now. And I said to you, "Hey, you want to hear something funny? I was talking to this girl last night and, you know, she said you were a coke dealer, and then you went, Amar, meet me in half an hour at Gypsy Co-op. Goodbye." Click.
In the back room.
And I'm like, what? Because, hey, I'm used to my buddy always being happy and go lucky, and I'm expecting you to laugh this off with me.
Yeah.
And you gave me the shortest, most serious conversation I've ever heard from you. And I'm thinking to myself, should I tell my family I'm going to Gypsy Co-op?
Don't come back.
Yeah. Should I tell them I spoke to Philip before I left? So I showed up there, you know, and the middle of the day, and you walked in, you sat down, right? You ordered, I can't remember what you ordered. And we're sitting there, and then boom, you just went. You said, "Buddy, I have something to tell you, but you got to promise me you can't tell anyone else." And that's why I'm glad you agreed.
Until today.
That's right. And that's a lot of our, well,
how
some
many
of
years
our,
later is this?
That's right. Well, a long time. Well, that's why I'm so proud of you, you know, that you're now working, you know, towards, you know, Buddhism, and you're helping people. You know, you've come a long way, and it's great to be able to see your growth and development, to ask you about this. You started sharing your story, and I was just completely blown away. So can you give us the Coles Notes version, please? Because right now it's like almost 1 o'clock in the morning in Da Nang, Vietnam. So give us the Coles Notes.
O'clock.
Okay, give us the Coles Notes version of how you got started from all the way back from, you know, high school, just boom, 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 that led you to start dealing coke.
Least likely of characters ever.
Oh, by the way,
involved.
Let me just add one other thing. This is important. You have never done cocaine in your life.
Never.
See? That for me, I can understand that, because when I met you, you wouldn't even smoke a joint. You were a drinker. You could drink a half a bottle of vodka, you know, in like an hour, but you wouldn't even smoke a joint. I mean, it was like years later, I convinced you to smoke a joint with me. So you were, you were clean in terms of drugs. I mean, like I said, you drank. So it's important for people to know, to this day, you have never done cocaine. Go ahead. Sorry. So where did this all start?
Going back, I grew up in a family that was very sports oriented, into hockey. You know, our sights set it on being professionals playing for the Toronto Maple Leafs.
I know you used to play with the guys from Blue Rodeo, right?
Blue Rodeo, tragically hip, Andrew Cash, that whole crew, because they all played together.
And they love hockey.
I love hockey, and I played with them. I didn't know who they were for like, I'm sure that was over four months playing with them once a week, and I didn't know who they were. Right until they won the Junos. And they said, hey, we all want Junos. I'm like, for what? You guys are like musicians. And I think musicians are like, they would wear their same clothes to play hockey in that they would wear all day long and on the street. It was all black jeans, black shirt, right? Black jacket. And they wouldn't shower. They would not shower. I was the only person that would shower. Right? And that's how they could see that I had this big swinging dick. And they were like, ooh, afraid of it. So... going back into the story of how it all started, came from a family of jocks. I was a jock. That was kind of my MO, sports guy. Loved it. Loved hockey. Played a lot. Hockey family. Hockey time, like the 60s.
And you were adopted, right, Philip?
No, I wasn't.
Not adopted. Sorry. You had shared a story with your mom and dad. You're not sure if, you know, your dad is your real dad or something like that.
No, I'm sure that he's not. So my mother calls me one evening. I'm living in my grandparents' condo. They live in Florida, in a house in Florida. So in the wintertime when they're away, I live with them, but I've lived with them all year round. And so she lives in the other condo in the same building. So she'd often call me at night. She'd have a glass of wine, nice meal, glass of wine. I just want to talk to you. I have something important to say. And I'm like, okay, Mom, whatever. Sure. And she was like my best friend. We got along really well. We like argued like brothers and sisters. It was like, just like brother and sister all the time.
Like you so, and I. You and I have had some doozy arguments too.
over craziness. Yeah. Lunacy. Yeah. We believe our opinion is like so important. But what I say is opinions are like assholes. Everyone has one, and all of them smell like shit, especially when they open up. So my mom and I, so she called, I have something to tell you. And I was always a little leery when she had something to tell me. I'm like, I don't know if I want to hear this. Because she told me some doozies, okay? Because she was like my best, like, I can only tell you. I'm like, are you sure? Don't you have another friend that you can tell this to? You know, like you got fucked last night from some guy. I'm like, come on, Mom.
She would tell you stuff like that? She would tell you stuff like that, Philip?
Her and I went to stay in our house in Florida when her mother passed away and my grandmother. So we went to stay for the last time before we sold our house there. So I took her to a club to party and everything. We're partying. So a guy picks her up. I don't see her for 2 days. She's gone for 2 days. I'm like, oh my God, in Florida. Okay. So someone's gone for 2 days in Florida. They're gone. The gators ate her, or like some serial murderer fucking just dismembered her and threw her to the alligators or something. This is like, so finally she comes home. Hey, I'm like, bitch, what the fuck you been? I've been working. So my mom, so she calls. I'm like, okay, what? Well, you know your older brother, he's 6 years older than you. I said, yeah. He goes, you're 6 years younger than him. I said, yeah, I can do the math. I can do the math. 6 years younger. Don't beat around the bush. Bitch, I got stuff to do. Just say what you got to say. Okay. So she says, well, your father and I weren't getting along. You know, we weren't getting along and we were arguing and everything. And I had an affair. The rich Jewish guy, the rich Jewish American guy, and basically you're the product of it all. So I'm like, so now most people would probably be devastated.
So let me get this straight. Life. You're half Jap, Jewish American prince. I don't even know if that's politically correct anymore. These days
it is now, because No, a Jewish American prince, because you just removed the princess. So yes, I am a Jewish American prince. So apparently he was apparently a very wealthy American. I don't know. His name was Rockefeller or something. I don't know. She really didn't say. Yeah, I didn't say. You know, I don't know. Oy vey. Ah, one day I'm going to die. Ah. So she goes, so basically, who you thought was your father all this time wasn't your father. Which means that my two brothers were my stepbrothers. What a weight had been lifted off.
Why? Of me.
Well, because I always thought my father was such a fucking idiot. I think if I'm his kid, I'm doomed. Right? And when I realized I wasn't, that I came from the genes of a rich Jewish American business guy that fucked my mom because she was hot. I'm like, I like that guy already. Right? So she goes, it was a while ago, because I was, I think, maybe 17 or 18 at the time, just finishing high school. And before going into college. And I was like, okay, cool. Okay, thanks for telling me, Mom. Thanks for sharing. Do you have any questions or anything? Or you want to know what I said? No, I think I know everything. I don't really need to know anything else. I think I got the Cole's notes on that one. So thanks so much. Good. Have a nice night. We'll see you tomorrow. And we'd often go for lunch on Sundays and brunch together. So the story goes back that grew up in a, I'd say, a bit of an affluent family. Not the worst of life, but not the best, but still great. Right?
Well, so your mom did well for herself, or your mom and stepdad were able to give you a decent...
No, we had a good lifestyle. We had a very good lifestyle.
Well, I mean, you were in Florida in the winters, so obviously you guys lived well, right?
Yeah, it was propelled by my grandparents, her mother and father, because he was a real estate tycoon.
Oh, really?
He was a real estate mogul. Yeah. He was the first realtor to hit, it was called the $7 million club. And the $7 million club was started in the 40s. Okay. So to sell $7 million in real estate back then, when houses were $10,000.
That's right. That's quite
sell a lot of fuck. It was like, it'd be like 20 years later. So he was in the $7 million club. He was the first one to reach the $7 million club in Canada, right? In Toronto specifically. So they get a ring. It had the ring. It had a horseshoe with the diamonds. Each year they put another diamond in it, each year that you excelled. Mm-hmm. So he won it all the time. So he was like a super overachiever with Snellgrove Real Estate. There's a big ups of Snellgrove Real Estate. Oh, wait, it doesn't exist anymore.
So fast track. To when you started doing drugs, was there any other highlights?
No, not doing drugs.
Oh, no, sorry, not doing. Yeah,
profiting.
Being a,
I'd like to say,
being a businessman.
A businessman. A businessman on the street. I mean, I'm a street pharmacist. Street pharmacist.
So, leading up to that, was there any other highlights or anything? You know, let's say your life is a movie, and in fact, I've told you this: your life could easily be a movie if directed well. Because I've known you. Yeah, no, absolutely. I guess everyone's life is a movie, but the fact that you've had, because I remember stories, for instance, I remember you telling me, you had $120,000 in cash and you reached your hand one last time in the hole because you had it in the ceiling. And you pulled out another pile, $10,000 pile, which, because you weren't even keeping,
No, there was no bookkeeping.
An account.
There's yeah, no there bookkeeping.
Was, that's right. That's right. So
throw it in a case.
So that's why I say, like, you've got everything necessary for an amazing film. So was there any other highlights between your mom and you finding out that your dad was not really your dad to starting dealing drugs?
I'd finished college, top of my class, Seneca College for fashion design. My goal was to become the best fashion designer in the fucking world. That was it. I did quite well for myself. I opened up a boutique in Yorkville Avenue at 134 Yorkville Avenue called Virtually Unknown. The reason it was called Virtually Unknown, because that's what a designer really is when he starts out. He's virtually unknown, but he wants to be known. So my next segment when I got there was going to be no.
So this was in York. This was in Yorkville. Yorkville. You said Yorkville, Toronto. Now, how long ago?
134 Yorkville Avenue between Hazelton Avenue and Avenue Road.
How long ago was
right
this?
Right across from the Four Seasons Sheraton.
How long was this?
1984.
Okay, so they had cars back then. It wasn't a horse path.
They had a few. but there was still horse shit on the road. I had to clean it every day. Every fucking day.
So,
yeah.
So, okay, so you did that. And then what happened? What led you to starting dealing
with trucks? My boutique was very successful. I had amassed a great deal of clientele. Now, the likes of Prince's group that came through, the two girls, Laura and Lisa, I guess. Brenda, I'm not too sure. I was positioned across the street from the Sheraton Hotel where all the stars would stay because that was the top hotel at the time for all the stars. Bar none, that's where they stay. So when Michael Jackson stayed there, his brother Jermaine and his crew shopped next door to my shop, which was 132, which was a men's shop. So my store was closed several times for celebrities coming in just to shop for themselves.
Oh, wow.
Yes. Laura Branigan came in, didn't know who she was. She bought like a lot of stuff, which was fantastic. I had just went the week before to New York City to buy stuff for my collections. So basically in a short stroke, I became the top Canadian designer in Canada.
Designer or importer?
Designer. Because I graduated as a designer.
Okay, gotcha.
Yes. So, but it wasn't enough for me just to say that I'm doing this. I had haute couture. I had my own like cotton line. I gave the other graduated designers in Canada a chance.
Now, let me ask you this.
Here's my store. You can put your stuff here. Let's see what you're going to do.
What makes you think you were the number one designer in Canada? And I'm not being facetious here, but, yeah. You know, like, were you recognized? Did anyone ever tell you that?
I had a collection of magazine articles this thick on my desk that people could open up.
Do you still have those?
No.
I would love to see that. See, you and I never spoke about that. We were too busy talking about vodka and tonic, and I was trying to be nice, but
yeah. In the DJ booth. So, hey, do you think in the DJ booth? Let's go for the washroom. Go right for the washroom. Actually,
oh, geez, the good old days. Anyway, but yeah. So, okay, that's interesting that you were from that background, because we never really spoke about that before. I knew you had the store, but I didn't realize that you were actually.
I was the top of the top, buddy. As the top of the top.
Okay.
Everybody. My partner was Winston Kong. He was the top designer in Canada at the time and into America as well. So I wasn't just, I've never been only regular schmo. I've just never been that guy. I rise to the top and then I go do something else. Mm-hmm. So I've got the store. It's going well, but not making as much money I would like it to make. I have dreams, goals, aspirations of being rich. That was kind of the legacy that my grandfather left me. That was my legacy of where I'm going to go in the future. I always wanted to be rich, even when I was a kid. I was the first at 7 years old to start my cutting grass, you know, getting my brothers to cut grass and making money off them.
Is that still an aspiration, or that you're done with that now? Gotcha.
Maybe one day it'll happen just out of like happenstance.
Gotcha.
Right, because that's how it all happens. Mm-hmm. But no, I was on it. Right, I grew up as a 60s, 70s, 80s hungry money making machine. Right, and with fueled by the fire of the family as well. So had the store doing well, but not what I wanted. I was hanging out with some specific people. I was hanging out with the elite, and they were all doing okay. I wasn't doing cocaine, but I didn't even know they were doing it. I really didn't know. I was invited to all the parties. I mean, there was just like lavish. We're talking the Medjucs, the Hoffmeyers, the richest Jewish families in Canada
Yeah. Let's not give.
They're at my table.
Yeah. But as we go forward, let's not give names of people who actually was your customer in cocaine. I don't want them to hunt us down. So these are just people you knew and you were. Yeah.
Exactly. I agree. Gotcha. It wasn't Mark McCain from the McCain family. It wasn't Brian Medjuck from the big mogul. It wasn't any of those.
Yeah. And you met these people. Else. You met these people because of the store, because you and being a designer. Yeah.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
Exactly.
Okay. So go on.
So then I had connections and friends. There was a family called the Tomasicchio family. Don't worry. Most of them are dead now. Don't worry. Anyway, or they're finished. So my best friend, Laura, her and I play tennis every day. And every day she'd come and pick me up in a Jaguar, a Benz, a Cadillac. It was like, how many cars does your fucking father have? She goes, I just take a different car every day, right? We live in this big mansion up north. So I don't know. So I said, what does your father do? She goes, we'll sit and talk. So she sits me down, just like I had to talk with you, she had to talk with me. She goes, this is what my family does. She goes, but we have some stuff on the go. I know you're not interested. I don't even want to, but my brother-in-law, blah, blah, blah. Why don't you have a talk with him? Next thing you know, I bought my first key.
Kilo.
No, wait, hold on. I don't want to get mixed up on this. Made my first ounce, $3,200. He comes, I close the door in the shop, I go to the back, opens up a tackle box, scale, blah, blah, blah. He shows me how to turn 32 ounces, which was not 28, but I'm on a different system now, into this. And this is how much it's going to cost me. This is how much I can make. I said, really? That's how much I can make? He goes, yeah, this is good now.
So did you say back then an ounce was 3,200?
Yes.
Okay, gotcha. Go on. And how pure was that?
The purest of the pure.
Okay, gotcha.
It can be broken down into like many different levels.
So what was the profit you were about to say?
Almost just about two-thirds of what the cost was. So you could almost double your money.
Wow. Okay.
So he shows me the whole thing, close it all up. Thank you so much. Here's your $3,200. Okay. Close the door. I go back. I sit down. And I realize I don't know anybody who does cocaine.
Or you thought you didn't.
Exactly. I thought I didn't because I wasn't in that world. I didn't do it. So I wasn't with them when they were doing it. They might've been around me at the parties. I was invited to everything. Okay, and the elite of the elite, like Hazelton Avenue, dude. You know how many fucking dudes live on Hazelton Avenue that are like having parties with girls every night and it's like going off and going crazy? But I had a girlfriend at the time, had Rose, right? So I was a good boy. I wasn't partying. I was on my business, I was on my game, had my girl, gonna get married. I was just doing my thing. It was business. That's all it was. It was a commodity. So when I looked at it, and that's what it was, it was like presented to me, it wasn't anything good or bad or indifferent. It was a commodity.
It was a business.
Supply, demand. Yeah. Supply, demand.
And what were you cutting it with? And did you actually do the cutting?
Yes. Yeah, it was like baby powder. And then we got more extravagant with cutting it with other stuff that was.
So baby powder, pardon my ignorance, you can snort that up your nose and you're fine? Like it doesn't mess you.
Well, I'm sure the whole experience messes people up, but it was the higher you are on the totem pole, the more clean it's going to be. When they get it down into the streets, then it's nothing. But that wasn't my business. Mine was the elite business. So that's
what I'm asking. What did you cut it with? For the,
because you were step on it. I could step on it with. I could step on it with baby powder and everything. And I don't actually, Amar, I don't remember all of the details about what it was. It was just all happening at the time to make it all happen.
And And you said you said you would step on it. Is that a slang that they use?
One step, two step. The further down the stairs, the lower it is from the top grade.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, so this started. So then I had made a dress for a beautiful, the most top beautiful famous model at the time, Lorraine Pinot. It was a dress that was red. It was cut down to her belly button. The slit on the back went right up to her pussy, and the slit on the back went right down to the crack of her ass. It was difficult to keep the dress on her body when she moved. I did this amazing fashion show. I did a fashion show that walked out of my store, my designer store on Yorkville Avenue, down the street into my friend's restaurant, through his restaurant on a busy Saturday night, through the back door and back into my salon, my boutique.
Wow.
It was covered by Toronto Life. It was covered by everybody, Jeannie Becker, everybody. Okay. Wow. This is the real fucking deal. It was the deal of the deal.
I didn't know all of this, Philip. That's amazing to me. Anyway, continue.
So I made her this dress and I said, you wear it in the show. And she goes, I want to buy it from you. I said, okay, great. It's $2,200. I said, you don't have the money. She was living above my store on the top floor on Yorkville Avenue. And she had money, but she's a model. So you can imagine where her money's going. So I said, okay, I said, I'm coming upstairs to your apartment now. I have to ask you something. So I walked in. I said, you owe me money for my dress, bitch. And she goes, yeah, I know, but I don't have it, honey. And I said, okay, show me the money. I said, this is what I just started. I started a new little cottage industry business out of my basement apartment. And I'm going to make millions. Not Microsoft. She goes, okay. She goes, come with me. We walk out of our building down to Hazleton Avenue, right there, walked up the street, walked into 54 Hazleton Avenue, met a fellow named Brian Medja. And that was the turning point where it was like I had just found the key. I just had to find the lock. So I found the giant lock. When I turned it, I could hear like vaults opening. The vaults were opening.
Hallelujah. Hallelujah.
And the music came. And the music came. And I was like, bring it on. Bring it on. So it was illustrious. It was, along with my business acumen, along with my development, my programming, my acceptation of every situation, my simplicity of design, within a very, very short period of time, I was making $10,000 a day.
A day?
A day.
Wow. Like you're talking
$10,000 a day.
You're talking $70,000 a week.
Yeah. Yeah. Easy.
Wow. Yeah.
And then there were higher days than that. And then there was bigger scores.
And so you were using that money to fuel your real estate business as well, correct?
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah, the real estate business had laundered every single dime with my simple systems. I had my own simple system. And I had one accountant, one business lawyer from Basil Sullivan Lee, a real estate lawyer. So basically an accountant, real estate lawyer. I had a team.
So how do you laundry all this cash with real estate?
I was buying the houses in cash.
Okay. I guess back then the laws weren't as strict as it is now.
Exactly.
The paper trail.
It was a different time. Under the wire. It was under the wire. It was 1985 started with the real estate, 1986 and 1987. I became a multimillionaire within 2 years.
Wow.
Rapid. People think it takes a long time. And yes, if you're fucking Jack Ma, but he's disappeared right now. I don't know where he went. Oh, my God.
No, so, they said he's back. They said he's back. Yeah. He's back. I just read. Anyway, go on.
He's back, but he's just not talking. They cut his tongue out. Oh, and then that's good because he shouldn't really say anything. If you ever see the interview with Elon Musk and Jack Ma,
No. Oh, no, Jack, I got to see that
Elon
one.
Musk just, no, Jack, Elon Musk was just like, you for fucking, and you, it was just, he was absorbed in his own, and I love Elon Musk, okay? Yeah. He's fucking out there.
Yeah, me too. So, I like him. But anyway, get back to, yeah.
So most people think that fortunes are made over a long period of time. They're not. They're made rapidly.
Certainly not in the drug dealing business.
Well, because it only lasts 2 or 3 years, and then the shit hits the fan.
So all of these people, right? These were all professionals. These were people that you wouldn't even know that were involved. You would seek out their services.
Lawyers, doctors, hospital workers, politicians. High profile lawyers. Yeah, can you imagine?
Right? Wow.
I'm going to condos on Bloor Street, dealing to high profile lawyers that are defending drug dealers the next day in court.
And did you carry a gun or anything like that?
No, that was my MO. That wasn't my necessity. Mine was all white collar.
So you didn't need to. You didn't need to.
It was all white collar. This is no rough and tumble. This was just on the up and up. This is just, gotcha. Like I said, another, it was like if I had set up a booth in Holt Renfrew on Bloor Street, that's what I would be selling of the day if it was legal.
So you're like the boutique drug dealer.
Yes, exactly. I was the, I was the Yorkville pro. Wow. Yeah. So, but I worked hard at it. I won't go into too many of the details, but it was interesting, nevertheless.
Anything interesting? Without, I know there are probably things you don't want to say, you know, because this is being recorded. But anything that would make people go wow? Because I'm already saying wow with some of this stuff. Anything else you want to share?
No, buddy, I'm the same way. I tell my story, and I'm like, holy fuck, this is so interesting. Tell us more. I keep talking, and it's like, no, shut up. No, come on, keep talking.
Now, speaking of models and hot models, did you ever have to get sexual favors for the money because the model or the hot girl wasn't able to go on? Yes.
And that was my rule, that I never, ever did that. I never, ever did that. I had a girlfriend at the time. I was very faithful. She was my beautiful sweetheart that I was going to get married to. She was completely aware. Her and I were business partners.
Okay.
She was completely aware of the situation. At one time, she had a little yellow kind of plastic Brandon toy, little tiny key container, plastic container. We had $250,000 in that container in the cupboard just in case. That was just in case.
Just to put it in perspective, that's probably $1 million today's worth, because we're talking 40 years ago, right?
Exactly.
Or talking 35. 40 years ago. Yeah. Wow.
It's $1 million. So we had in today's margins, $1 million in the closet just in case. And that wasn't the only place.
Yeah. And I also want to add, you know, you said about being faithful. One of the things I know about you is that when you do have a girlfriend, you are like, boom, you're loyal to the bitter end and you're extremely faithful. So I'm not surprised. So at the time when you were doing this, you had a girlfriend, so you wouldn't have engaged in any extra play on the side.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was offered to me and I just say no. You pay the money, that's all. There's no trade-offs here. I was faithful because I was just this, you know, really straight shooter, you know.
Did you have a collections department, like a big guy named Bubba that will go and break legs if people didn't pay you?
No, it was just me. But I was so nice. I was so nice. This one guy owed me money and he couldn't pay. And he was just, oh, yeah, well, tomorrow I get it. I'm getting it. So I didn't mind going a little bit in because they'd already given me so much. But this guy had a TR7, you know, the old British TR7.
Yeah, they're beautiful. I love them. I still love them.
Nice. It was fucking nice. Okay? Mm-hmm. It was army green TR7 with a sticker, the whole thing, convertible. And I could see what was, I could see the writing on the wall. I can always see the writing on the wall before anyone even picks up a marker to write on the wall. So I'm looking at, okay, what has he got? Right? How far am I going to go with this? Because he turns me on to other people. Right? So what I get from him, what he takes in the background, if I can get any kind of collateral afterwards, I'm fine with that. So I said, listen, buddy. And he was a nice enough guy. I said, your car, tomorrow I'm coming to pick it up. Could you wash it for me, please? I don't want to really drive it because it's dirty.
Come on. Did you really say that?
I really said that. He fucking laughed and he knew it was coming. So I took the car. I sold the car. Wow. I drove it around for a while. I loved it. I drove it around, but sold it. Yeah. So if there was any kind of collections, it was, I didn't go in too deep, or I just cut my losses.
Okay.
Said, okay,
so there were some people where they just wouldn't pay and you just cut the ties and move on. Because you were making so much money.
Yeah, it didn't matter. And they would have referred people to me, so I took that into consideration.
Gotcha.
Right? And then I also took into consideration their position. Right. And then I took into consideration whether I should continue with them because they're going down a slippery slope. Some of them were completely functional, well orchestrated people.
Even though they were doing cocaine, they were managing it properly without overdoing it.
Yeah. And those are the people that I were involved in. So it wasn't as if I was down in the trenches.
Did you ever see anyone really like hit rock bottom because of, you know, cocaine?
I saw some people go down low, but that's where they go to get back up. Now, I didn't get to see it because they would have been removed from the equation prior to me kind of being along their side. And I would have removed myself as well.
So you weren't interested in giving it or selling it to someone that was in a, you know, that was already on their way down?
No, it was just like, you can go get somebody else to take you down. If it's not enhancing or benefiting you, or just kind of, it's not a recreational, then I'm out of here. Now, that was the case with one Bruce Bronfman. You might have heard that name in the news over the last decade or something.
Yeah.
They own a few places.
Yeah.
So he was protected by his friends. So his friends would alert me first. Hey, he's got him some trouble. His parents are calling us because they're all friends.
Yeah, gotcha.
All these rich Jewish guys are all friends. Right? They're all going to Forest Hill together, Upper Canada College. So they, all they have to do is say, hey, no more. And I go, okay, no more. That was it. So that was the situation. So I had the benefit of being in an elite system of hierarchy because where I was getting my stuff, it was coming right off the plane.
And where you were getting it from, was that the people you wouldn't want to mess with, or like who were they? Because you're not your typical drug dealer. You cut your losses. You are a typical drug dealer in my world. You know, you'll pull a gun out and say, "Have the money by tomorrow."
Where the fuck the money?
That's right. That's right. That's how, you know, you see this on TV. You see this on, you know, in the movies. So was it like that above you?
No, because it was, everyone's making money. When everyone's making money, everything's fine. So people start to lose money, deals go sour. That wasn't happening. So I just met the right people. Right? I always meet the right people. The right people come to me. Yes, we get lots of wrong people, but I get more of the right people than the wrong people. Mm-hmm. And the right people just put things together for me because they can see the numbers I can do when I put my mind to it.
And as well, so, correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, if you're dealing with the right people, white collar people, people who can afford you know, this this luxury, and I call it a luxury because it's an expensive drug, then the chances of you getting busted is extremely low, right? Because they have as much to lose as you do, right? And so versus, you know, someone in Skid Row who is, you know what I mean? Give me a hit. You know what I mean?
That guy.
Yeah. So how did you ultimately get busted?
Interesting story. Things were going well. And when things are going well, you could get out. But just one more deal. Just one more deal. And I was saying one more real estate deal. So my largest real estate deal, I had bought 250 acres in Bolton, flat, beautiful land, from one road to another, double access.
How much did it?
20 acres. I bought it for $215,000.
Wow.
And beautiful.
That would have still been about $1 million today. But that land now is probably what, 100 million, 50 million? I don't even know.
It's probably all developed. All houses because it was a special. It was going to be Highway 50 used to get so blocked up with people going into Bolton from the city and everything at nighttime. That was the thoroughfare. So this was the alternative route. Perfect, right down my street. Gotcha. Right now, the other side of the house had power and water. The vision or whatever?
Yeah.
Did not, but that was fine. We were working with our architects. Everything was fine. The city was looking at the money I was going to put in. I was building the largest indoor and outdoor banquet hall, wedding facility and party facility in Canada. This was my dream.
So getting busted, how did that happen?
Well, when you get too big, a lot of people know your name. And there's times where I scaled back. I had actually scared myself. I had 250 customers. I was busy. Dude, I was fucking busy. I was the first guy that had the mobile phones. It cost me $6,000 each for a phone.
The brick phone
from the General Electric, not the big one from Motorola. The next one scaled down. Bought it from North and South, $6,000. I bought myself one and my girlfriend one, $12,000 cash. Then what happened? It's $1 a minute. Every time we talk to each other for a minute, it's $1. Then she goes to Europe for 2 months because she's studying opera in Graz and she's becoming an opera singer. We're talking every day on the phone. My bills were $10,000 a month just for my phone.
Wow.
$10,000 a month just for my phone.
One day's work.
For talking on my phone. One day's work. Exactly. So I could pay for my month in one day for that. So I made a deal with a guy, but he was kind of suspicious. But it was a pretty good deal. And how the cops kind of play it, they try to get you to deliver some up front and then they'll do the other half after, sort of. So that gets you to go somewhere. So you go somewhere. So you lead them somewhere. So this particular day, I scheduled a meeting with my business partner, and we met in an alleyway.
Business partner for the land? Is that what you're talking about?
No. I was talking about the busted thing.
Your customer. You're being facetious. Customer. Your customer.
Yes, exactly. Well, my business partner.
Yeah.
And we're all in this together, aren't we? So he gets in and we kind of do the transaction as normal. But as I look down the alleyway where I park, I see, and it's quite a ways away, I see a car stop at the end of the alleyway and I kind of see, and it's from a far way away, but I had good eyes. I had good eyes, you know, your instinct increase when you're in that environment, right? Because you have to go into protection mode. And I look down and we stop and then they pull away. And I thought, you know what? Something's wrong. out of here. Get the fuck out of here. I go. So I'm thinking, am I imagining it? Is this the day? Is this the day they all talk about? And I'm driving. And I not only did I have the money from that deal that was $6,000, I always had $10,000 with me in case I wanted to buy something. I always had 10,000 cash with me no matter where I went. If I went out at night, the rest, I had 10,000 just in case. Just in case.
And I can attest to that. Every time we would go out, you would pull out 50s and 100s. And I'd be like, Philip, where do you get this money from? It was amazing. And you were extremely generous too, which was great. Anyway, go on.
So I'm driving. And I'm driving back to go get the other half. Oh, thinking in my mind something's wrong. But I'm looking behind me. I'm watching. I know if someone's following me. Nobody can follow me, Amar. I don't care if you're the best fucking RCMP. I don't care if you're fucking undercover fucking ninja. You're not going to be, I will know you're following me. Right? Right? You, unless you have so many fucking components going on and fucking drones and everything, which they didn't, you're not going to get away from my eyesight. I'm looking at everything in fucking 360 all of the time, every mirror, everything. It's just all going on while I'm thinking about all of my next things, moves, days, everything. So I'm coming up on Bloor Street just around Christie, and I look in my rearview mirror and I see these two guys with sunglasses on, and they're kind of like maybe three cars back. And I'm like, holy fuck. I think this is actually happening. I think these are the guys. These are the guys. Well, I got some stuff on me still. I got some money on me. And
did you have any cocaine on you as well?
Yes, yes.
Oh, okay.
And some individual packets that were quite unique. So I realized what was happening. And I thought, well, I'll shake them, but if they show back up again, then I know it's real. I got away from them. I shook them. I pulled down a side street. I got into a parking spot in front of a house, and I was just sitting there, the seat retracted, looking through my side view mirror. I see a car coming down, and it's an Impala. Fucking Impala. Well, Impala is always a police car. Right? So it's coming down. So it kind of goes by me. And I'm like, keep going, keep going. It stops. Brake lights come on. Reverse lights come on. Now it's real. What I should have done, as soon as I parked the car and I had lost them, I should have taken my satchel with everything out, walked through the driveway of the house, climbed the fence into the park, and took off. The reason I didn't do that is I wanted to know, am I really being followed? Mm. What if my paranoia got away from me and I go home and I'm all freaked out and nothing's fucking happening? You have to have kind of some volition. You have to have some, is this really happening, right? So what ends up happening? As soon as that happens and they put their reverse lights on, here we go. I was in a 320i BMW. It wasn't registered in my name. It wasn't my car. Nothing was registered in my name. My phones weren't
That's
in my
name. That's the white BMW. Is that the white?
This is another guy's BMW.
Because when I met you, you had a white BMW that I ended up buying off of you.
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
Fucking anyway, go awesome on. Car.
It was.
Awesome. So I'm like, here we go. The chase is on. The reason the chase was on, I knew I had to get away from them long enough to throw everything out of the window. I had to throw the drugs out of the window. I had to throw the money out of the window.
Wow.
Well, it's not easy to throw money out of the drugs out of the window. Throwing money out of the window is fucking hard. Okay. The window's there. It's like stuck to your hand. It's like you just can't fucking do it.
You just can't part with it.
You just can't part with it. Right. So it was a, because I just, I'll explain it away later. So the chase was on, buddy. I was in a police chase. Rush hour traffic, 5 p.m., lure in Ossington, flying through an intersection on a red light. I need you to focus here. Because you look very attractive in the focus.
Yeah. Sorry. I'm actually, I have my, you know, I do day trading. And I actually see a trade coming and I might take it as a, it's always in the background. So I apologize. But anyway, I can focus.
Don't
now.
Lose any money. Don't lose
That's
any
right.
money.
That's right. Exactly. Trade. I, don't no, I can focus trade. Now. Go on.
Okay. So I'm in a car chase. So I'm in this BMW, black BMW, not registered to me, but just everything. I was anonymous. Okay. Everything I had. I paid $10,000 a month for a team to scan my car, to scan my house for bugs.
Wow. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. I had bugs that I could meet in someone's car. I could drop this little thing inside your ashtray and leave it there. I could go back to my car, turn on my radio to a certain frequency, and I could hear everything you're saying. So I could spy on my customers.
Did you ever have to do that?
A few times, yeah.
Oh, really? Why?
Yeah. I was playing with the big boys, so I had to know what was going on.
Just in case they put a hit out on you or something. Was that ever?
No. That wasn't part of the equation. That's not.
Why specifically?
Because. Who they're dealing with, what my price is, am I getting screwed, who's it coming from, can I cut them out of the bureau because I know who they're dealing with, I'll just go to them. There was a few things.
Oh, yeah. Really?
So I had a team. So I had a team. $10,000 bucks a month just on the team to scan my cars and my house constantly.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. It was like 007. They'd open up the briefcase and they had all these new things and we're trying this out. It was all new. So I was trying it out with these guys that were just getting stuff from different parts of the world, but we were all paying for it. Right. I was selling that to other drug dealers.
Wow.
Right. To protect them. Right. More guys as well. So it was a big deal.
So you had friends, that were dealing drugs as well. And you guys kept, did you divide the territory or you just kept your customers? Like, did it matter?
No. When you're dealing, one source or supply always runs out. So you have to have another one. So you all work together. We were one big team. Yeah. Oh. We're one big team working in unison.
Okay. So drug dealers like yourself, you would work together and they were making 10,000 a day as well, or, you know, making a lot of money as well.
Some were making less, some were making more.
Okay.
Depending on where they were, who they were. I knew everybody. So the chase is on and I know all I have to do is get far enough away from them to throw this package out of the window. And then I got to stop or get away from them. But they're on me. There's three police cars and one media car behind them. Media car being like the, police are in pursuit with the camera guys. So I'm looking in my rearview mirror and this is like streets of San Francisco. I mean, where I'm fucking flying. I'll come up on a red light at Lure and Ossington. It's red. I'm going right through, right? Hell or high water, I'm going through. Now, they got jarred up a little bit. It got me to the second intersection. I turned right. I'm going so fast, I'm almost up on fucking two wheels. I threw the bag out the window. I keep going. I took on the next street. I stop, put my stuff in the satchel, everything. I sit there. They stop, out of the cars, doors open, fucking guns drawn, hands on your head, that whole fucking thing. I've got my nice black leather jacket on. I've got my white shirt. I was always dressed very nicely, right? Like, okay, this is it, right? But I'm not worried. I'm not concerned. I'm just like, this is just a bleep in the map. I've got enough money to buy my way out of this.
Oh, really? Is that how you actually felt? Was that the reality or is that just how you felt?
Well, the reality is kind of there's adrenaline going, but I've never been scared shitless, right? No, I've never been scared shitless. I'm like, this is just happening. I deal with it.
Going to jail was not a, like.
Well, I didn't think that was going to be a possibility.
Okay.
Right? Yeah, I didn't think that was going to be a possibility. So okay, guns drawn. Get out of the car. Back in the car. The guy's trying to take the pictures. I said, get them the fuck out of here. I won't talk to you if I see these guys over here. These guys, they're RCMP.
What do you mean taking pictures? Reporters?
Yeah, there's one reporter car. In the chase, there's three police cars. Mm-hmm. Three police cars. RCMP, not just regular cops.
Okay.
Right? And a film. Like a TV crew looking for stories. I was worried that I'd hit the news because I was a very well-known business person.
Business.
So
business person.
Hey, what do you got going on? It's business. I got it. Yeah, so it all started from there. I contacted there was some rigmarole. They asked me to talk, this and that. I said, I got nothing to talk about, nothing. Got nothing. Now, the truly unfortunate thing is I should have thrown away the money because they had marked the money.
Oh, geez.
The guy who gave me the money marked the money.
Right? So you throw out the coke, but not the money.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. I should have thrown the money, but dude, I just couldn't. It was like, I don't even know how to explain it. Like there's just nothing. Throw away money.
Mm.
So anyway, but now unfortunately I had my other $10,000. And because that was like, well, when they go after you for the proceeds of that money, I'm like, no, that was laundered through my real estate company. That's real money. Anyway, my lawyer said, don't go after it, because if you go after it, then they're going to ask for more.
Mm-hmm.
So I got away with, let's say, a bit of a slap on the wrist. Anyway, the police chase was fun. And it was interesting.
That you didn't get busted that time.
No, I got busted. They took me back to the RCMP building, the whole thing. Yeah.
Did you do jail time though?
Yeah, for that one I did eventually, yes.
How many years or months or?
No, it was just 6 months in a minimum security in the Bath institution that was like kind of, you sleep in your own bed, you wear your own clothes, there's no fences. I worked in the confectionery where you sold stuff. Dealing with money and everything was great. I was the hairdresser. I was cutting hair. It was the same one that Ballard had stayed in. And also the same one that Conrad Black ended up staying in.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Not at the same time.
It was a very fine resort as prisons go.
Did you have to pay extra for that or? Or no, just negotiation with your lawyers.
That was my lawyer because I had one of the top lawyers. So you know who Clayton Ruby is, right?
No, I don't.
Okay, well Clayton Ruby is one of the top lawyers. Okay. Maybe still is. Well, his second in command was West something. So he was my lawyer.
So top
criminal. So he negotiated. Yeah, top criminal lawyer.
Okay.
So basically, I told my real estate lawyer, I said, get me the best. He goes, I got it. You're getting Clayton Ruby. So then he says, I couldn't get Clayton Ruby. I have to get West. I can't remember who it was. He goes, he's the second best. I said, in Canada? And he goes, yes. I said, okay. So he was. So he cut me a great deal.
Nice. Yeah.
So I got bail.
How much did that cost you?
My bail was $50,000. So okay. Rose, my girlfriend, had to go into her little box in her closet and pick out some money. I told him to tell her just bring $200,000 just in case. So she did. So in her bag, she's like, you know, young Italian girl coming to court to bail out her drug dealing boyfriend. Not going to go over well with the Sicilian family. That's going to be great because they had no idea.
Oh, geez. No, so her family had no idea that you were doing this.
No idea. Oh, no.
Oh, man. No. And once they found out, what happened?
Well, Well, now let's just put it, their family comes from Sicily.
And we'll leave it at that.
And we'll leave it at that. But their uncle.
I can tell. I've known you long enough. I can tell when a conversation is going in an uncomfortable area. So if you don't want to incriminate anyone or say anything else,
let's just put it this way: her uncle. I said when I met him in Sicily, because we spent 6 months in Sicily with the family. I said, "Hey, what do you do?" "I'm retired." "So what did you do before you retired?" "I had a little soap company in Corleone." He goes, "I kept everything clean." I said, "Okay, I understand." No, did he I'm actually? Not lying. Yes, he wow. actually said this, buddy.
Wow.
Buddy. And I was standing there, and I'm like, fucking right on. I like this guy. Him and his wife were addicted to going to casinos. So they had befriended very much so his niece, which is Rose, and me, to drive them around from casino to casino. We went to Monte Carlo. We went to San Remo. He goes, "Next time we want to go," I think he said, "we want to go to Russia to a casino. You want to come with us? We pay for everything." Right? Wow. That's how in this situation was. So when the family has a bit of a hiccup with the son-in-law, with the future son-in-law getting busted, it wasn't a big deal. Okay. We're talking about, you know, beheading, murders. I met the bosses of the bosses when we were in Sicily. So yes, it was probably very difficult in Canada.
So you met some of the most like the biggest. Big fish, rootless, whatever, the top, like, wow.
Top. Yeah. So the biggest guy, Salvatore Michelli, we meet him because he wants to buy my Jeep. Because when we went over there, I shipped my Jeep over there.
That's the kind of money you had. Yeah.
The kind of money I had. And I had another, that was my cheap Jeep. I left my Cherokee Limited in Canada. It cost me $32,000 at the time, and I paid cash.
Mm-hmm. Three days' work. Yeah, I'll exactly keep adding that.
Exactly. It's just like, what, how many days is that? 3 days. How many minutes? It doesn't matter. So that situation, yes, I did meet some major guys. This one, Salvatore Michelli, for 10 years, he had to live out of being transported from villa to villa in the trunk of a car. Okay. He was so sought after, like, because he was like the biggest of the biggest. So when we hung out with him, he fucking loved me. He was amazing. He took me to the top when we drove up to his house. I mean, it was driving up to this villa on a hill in a mountain with these 10 white dogs running beside us. They were like this amazing breed, swimming pool and everything. And we get out. It's like, "Hey, come on, come inside." That was some everything. So he takes me aside. We talk. And he goes, "Hey, how far can you see?" "I see how fucking can see far, can see everything." He goes, "I used to own 10 times and the fucking police took it away from me. Fucking killed him." He was like that kind of guy, right? But very good looking, very good looking. And for family, all very good looking. Mm-hmm. He goes, so basically was showing me like his thing. So I was invited into the family. Let's put it that way. There was a point where we were driving around. He was showing me different villas all over. He goes, "Where do you want to live? Where do you want to live? You're just part of us now." Mm-hmm. Now, her mother and father encouraged us greatly to please come back to Canada. Please come back to Canada. I said, "Why? The fucking love us here. It's amazing." So you don't know how it works.
When you once you gave it up, the drug, or what made you gave it up? I mean, to walk away with that kind of cash, because like you said, you know, to throw away cash was one of the hardest things. And, you know, you were like being a drug dealer, it just seems like something you'll do for the rest of your life, you know, and, you know, what made you said, you know what, enough is enough. I even though the money is freaking amazing, what made you give it up?
Well, Amar, it was against the law, and I don't like to break the law.
You finally realized it was against the law.
My mother always told me I'm a slow learner, right? Like Forrest Gump.
And I remembered you always used to say, my grandfather used to say, you know, you're good at something. We just don't know what it is yet.
Yes.
So maybe being a Buddhist, maybe being a Buddhist might be the final chapter in this beautiful life of yours.
Possibly. But that is to be determined through the course of time.
We only have a few minutes left, and this might, the Zoom call might conk out. I set it for 2 hours, and it's already been almost two. Just to wrap things up, Philip, first of all, thank you so much for doing this. And to, you know, because I know a lot of our friends, although they knew that you were involved in this, and certainly, you know, a lot of them don't even know, and even more so, don't even know the details. And although I knew a lot more details, I'm still shocked by some of the revelation you've given us here today. What made you quit? And what was the best part about being a drug dealer?
What made me quit? Well, I did quit because I got in trouble. It's like I got caught. Right. So like a comedian one time went to a prison. I think it was maybe Johnny Cash. He goes, you know, the only difference between me and you is talking to the prisoners. He goes, you got caught. I didn't. So everybody's doing something. Mm-hmm. They just got caught. So I got caught. Now that just changed it all. Changed it all. Like regrouped, whole thing, restructured, get back in. Get married. I took off to Europe, lived in Europe for 3 years. Now, come back, fast forward, 1990. I was living in that amazing loft.
Warehouse. Yeah, it was a beautiful, beautiful warehouse loft.
And the parties mm-hmm. we had and the girls.
It was so cool because you would ride your motorcycle right in the living room and park it. Like, we had amazing
time.
Sheila.
There. And yeah. I think you had your bike in there one time mm-hmm. and then the other girl.
Yeah.
And the stuff that we did in that place was phenomenal.
We won't go there.
And it's just too good. They wouldn't believe it. They wouldn't believe it. They think we're lying. And we are. We're lying about everything. Everything is just a lie. We're just talking here. Just a lie. Nothing's real. So I was coerced back into it by the demons of money again and the quick deal of someone saying, hey, how about we make this one deal? Put this deal together. You're kind of set for a while. Well, that deal turned into two deals, three deals, four deals. And then one night, my good friend Amar and I, we go off to see a hockey game at the Maple Leaf Gardens. We're watching the North Stars versus the Toronto Maple Leafs. I don't know who won. Maybe it was 3-2. I don't know. But we go back to my club, and I'm feeling like a big shot. We're playing pool with Nella. Nella, my sister-in-law, in Bohemian, my club. Mm-hmm. I get a call from the police. Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you? This is not me. This is...
Well, your car has been broken into outside of your club, and the bag we found down the street had something in it, and we want you to come down and claim it. So that night, I had to go to the police station to claim my bag that had something inside of it, and I shouldn't have. But just being the person that I am, that I have to have closure.
So this was the second time you're getting in trouble with the law. You had taken a break, you decide one last time, then you got sucked back into it, and then, boom, someone breaks
just
into your car.
I thought I was out, sucked back in.
So... this is crazy. So someone broke into your car and that's how you got busted. Mm-hmm. Anyway, go on.
Now, whether that was scripted by the police, because not only that, my house was broken into and my stuff was stolen. They were looking for the same thing. So I kind of think there was a faction of one of my clients that was participating in a coup.
Gotcha.
And it had a bit to do with the mafia as well at the time.
Why? They didn't want you playing in their game anymore?
No. They just wanted to take what I had, in short order without paying for it.
Okay.
And so it was a bit of a dilemma. So that was the second time. Now, you mentioned the name change. The unique thing is that worked in my favor, because when I went that night, they looked at it and said, well, there's nothing else going on with this guy from before. Let's just let him go. And I walked out of there.
Because you had changed your name.
Yes, and got into my car that was parked very far down the street from the business. So only to go home and to realize again that my house has been broken into. So what do? Just for a short order. I want to know who the fuck broke in my house. So I call the police and say my house has been broken into, because now I know I can claim on my insurance policy. Because I had some artwork missing. There was some artwork missing from my wall. It was verified by my friend Paul Conway, the art dealer.
Wow.
So what I lost, I got back.
Gotcha.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Wow.
That night that you and I went to watch the North Stars game, one of the best nights of our life.
Yeah.
Was another night that was happening behind the scenes while you were home sleeping and dreaming of Nina or whoever.
Yeah, probably Nina.
Probably Nina at the time. Oh, my dear, my dear. I was living a different life in that moment onto something else. But now that in itself was tragic, because there was some time that went with that. But that being said, it wasn't the worst case scenario, because I flew under the radar again. So no matter what has happened to me, Amar, in my life, for anybody else, it would have been 10 times worse. But for me, it was 10 times better.
And you know what? I want to end it on that, because I think that's a good place to end it. And I just want to... Can you read that quote for me again? Mahatma Gandhi quote in your room? Live as if you were to die tomorrow. Learn as if you were to live forever. Mahatma Gandhi. Philip Princeton, buddy, thank you so much. That was awesome. I don't know if you're going to be a Buddhist monk a year from now, 5 years from now. If I had to bet, I would say there's no freaking way. I've known you long enough. Maybe no.
But what are the odds, Amar? What are the odds? Let's get into this.
But here's what I do know. You will be happy. And you're one of the happiest guys I know, and peaceful guys I know. And so keep it up, buddy. I miss you. I miss hanging out with you. We got to play chess again real soon. And
online, chess.com. We'll play chess online.
Yeah, so go get some sleep. I know it's like 1 o'clock in the morning there. Yeah. And thank you so much. And I'll send you a copy of this, and we'll stay in touch. Okay, pal?
Amazing. Thank you so much, Amar. I'm really happy that we had this opportunity to chat and talk. Thank you. And I'm very happy that we're lifelong friends.
Love awesome, you. Buddy. Namaste. Take care. Bye.